Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Frank Turner is an English punk and folk singer and songwriter. He began his career as a vocalist of post-hardcore band Million Dead, then embarked upon a primarily acoustic-based solo career following the band split in 2005. To date, Frank has released 10 solo albums, 4 Rarities compilation albums, 1 retrospective best-of album, 1 split album, and 5 EPs. Frank's 9th studio album, FTHC, was released in February 2022 and reached number 1 in the UK albums chart in the week following its release. To date, he has had 6 of his albums reach the top 10 on the UK albums charts, including the 2024 Undefeated, which reached number 3. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Frank Turner.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
First of all, thank you for having me. I am currently in Cardiff, the capital of Wales. I'm on a UK tour. We're nearing the end of it, but it's been great. And I had a day off yesterday, so I did absolutely nothing other than have a bath. And I'm feeling pretty good. So yeah, I'm raring to go.
I'm sure having a bath and doing nothing is always, I need to have one of those days, actually.
Yeah, I mean, before that, I hadn't had a day off for 10 days, which is, now that I'm creaking into my 40s, that's quite a long time.
Okay, let's unpack that. You've referenced it, so I'm going straight into it. When you guys are touring, you know, the audience members come to one show. They experience once, maybe a couple more if they're super fans, but you guys are hopping on and off buses. You're in this place, you're in that place, this city. How do you maintain energy and balance and body-mind balance through a tour?
Well, I guess what I would say is that, I mean, the first thing to say is I've been doing this since I was 16. So that's 26 years of experience of doing this. So it's funny, like there is a sort of unspoken sort of assumption among some people that there is a quote unquote normal life that I'm sort of on some sort of holiday from. And that's very much not the case for me. Like, you know, this is normal to me. So yeah. I'm quite sort of well tuned into it. It's changed as I've got older, you know, like there was a moment when you're touring in your 20s when it's just an endless stag do and everybody gets hammered the whole time. It's because you're in your 20s and you're invincible. So fine. But that has changed as I've got older. And we had a wonderful moment a few years ago. We did some shows with a guy called Jason Isbell, who you may know, who's an American country singer. And Jason is sober and he doesn't enforce sobriety backstage. But the fact that he's sober and indeed his family were there, it was like a window. This was 2017. It was a window into a different type of touring for me and my band, because it was more like a glass of wine and telling some stories around the dressing room after the show, as opposed to Jaeger bombs and finding drugs or whatever it might be, you know what I mean? And it was like, oh, there's another way of doing this, which was really nice. So I drink a lot of water. I tend to eat on my own because I take my book with me, and that's quite a good kind of grounding experience, you know. But in terms of the energy and stuff, I mean, the show that we do is extremely physical. I generally come off absolutely soaked head to foot in sweat at the end of the show and exhausted and quite often injured in some minor way. And what that means is that you generally spend your daytimes conserving energy. Do you know what I mean? There's a fair amount of kind of like hibernation, and I tend to eat kind of like a lot of carbs about 3 hours before the show and stuff like that. So there are kind of things that you get used to over the years that enable you to sustain this.
Okay, so you reference that you've been doing this since the age of 16. So let's rewind your journey in the music world. At what age, was it at 16 or pre to that, did you feel, cool, this is the path I want to take? And how did that journey proceed? I know it's 26 years. So the Frank Turner hybrid story.
Okay, I'll do the quick version. I mean, I fell in love with music and rock and roll and specifically metal when I was about 10 years old. I stumbled across the music of Iron Maiden slightly randomly. Before then, obviously, I'd heard modern music, but my parents don't have a record collection for me to browse. You know, they listen to classical music and hymns and stuff like that. They're religious people. So, which is all fine, but I discovered Iron Maiden, which was pretty different, as you might imagine. And like nobody else I knew was into it. So it was mine. It was my thing.
Okay.
And in the way that 10-year-old kids do, particularly nerdy kids, because I was like a scholarship kid and stuff when I was younger. I got so hard into it. Like I learned the words to all the albums like it was a school project and all this kind of thing. I got very into it. And then, you know, this being the mid-90s, I got into Nirvana. And then Kurt Cobain talks about punk quite a lot. And then Offspring and Green Day came out. And I got into that kind of SoCal punk thing. And then, you know, I think right from the word go, from when I discovered Iron Maiden, I wanted to be a musician. My immediate thought was like, how do I get involved in doing this myself? So I got a guitar for Christmas and started learning guitar and stuff. Not well, I might add, for quite a long time. But by the time I was kind of 15, 16 years old, I had a few bedroom bands that I'd been in. And I progressed from punk into hardcore. And specifically, I had the book Get in the Van by Henry Rollins, which is his tour diary of the Black Flag years. And I was reading underground zines and all this kind of thing. And there was just this very kind of pure kind of DIY spirit. It's like, what do? Bands tour. How do you book a tour? You book it from a zine, the BYOL page in a zine, and you just call random strangers and ask if you can play a few songs in their venue. And some of them say yes. Do you know what I mean? And, yeah. And so through all of that, me and some friends booked our first tour in the summer of 98 from a payphone at our school. And we did 2 weeks, two bands in one van playing shows. Some of them were great. Some of them were terrible. We showed up in Salisbury and the venue had never even heard of us. So, you know, we played a squat show in Leeds that's remains one of the greatest shows I've ever been on the stage for. It was utter, utter bedlam. So, you know, there was a lot of kind of new experiences. And it was kind of funny when we got back from the tour, about half the people who'd been in the van were like, I will never, ever do that again. And the other half are like, when do we go again? And so I can't say that I toured constantly from age 16, but, you know, every school holiday from then on, whatever, me and my friends would book a tour. That band I was in at the time was called Knee Jerk. That came to an end, and two of us formed a band called Million Dead. And the bass player in Million Dead sort of, she worked, her day job was she worked for a major label. And so she knew what a booking agent was and what a manager was and like what real venues were and all this sort of shit. So that second band, Million Dead, kind of got an independent record deal. And, you know, we did tour supports at kind of 2,000 cap venues. And we got to a point where we could sell about 600 tickets pretty much anywhere in the UK, and it built up like that. And then after 4.5 years of touring pretty hard with that band, it came to an end. We all fell out with each other. At the time, I felt like I had been let down by other people in the band. I'm sort of old enough now to understand that I was probably as responsible for it as anybody else. Nevertheless, the fact of having been let down, actually twice, because that's how the first band I was in ended as well, I was like, fuck everybody else, I'm going to do this on my own. And I'd also started listening to a lot more kind of country, folk, Americana, roots, whatever words you want to use. Neil Young, basically, and kind of Nebraska era Springsteen and the Johnny Cash American recording series. And I had this idea of playing acoustic music. And at the time, everybody thought I was having a psychotic episode because it was a very unlikely thing to do at the time. It's a slightly better worn path now. But I mean, I genuinely, friends of mine were like, are you okay? Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I thought I had a plan. And it's funny because now looking back, all my friends think I must have had a plan. And I think I must have been crazy. So it's flipped over the years.
Yeah.
But then, so I started touring solo in 2005. And then just, I did about 3 years of touring on my own on the train, just playing anywhere, house shows, squat shows, bar shows, venues, support tours, whatever. And then, as was always the intention, eventually picked up a band piecemeal, slowly got a bunch of guys together who became the Sleeping Souls. There's been a couple of lineup changes over the years, but broadly speaking, that's been an entity now for 16 years or so. I don't know. And then just started putting out records and everything sort of got bigger and bigger as time went by. And now I'm talking to you. And that's a very short version.
I was looking at the biography. You released an album early on this year. You've been releasing consistently over the period of time. So from 0 to 3 to 4 minutes in creating a song, what motivates it? What invigorates it? Is it easy every time? Let's unpack your creative brain.
I mean, I guess it's a difficult question. It's a good question, but it's a difficult question. There isn't a set kind of process for songwriting for me. Sometimes a song will arrive in 20 minutes, fully formed. Sometimes a song will take 10 years to get right. Sometimes I'll finish a song, put it on the back burner, come back to it 5 years later and tweak two things and then go, there it is, it's good to go. And then from time to time, not that often, I'll finish a song and then just bin it off because I'm like, that, you know, that idea is everything it was ever going to be. And what it is, that what that is not much. So there's that. I mean, in some ways, my creative brain is constantly scanning. The best metaphor I've come up with it for it is fishing. You know, you put your rod out and you hope that something bites. And you know, the kind of the ineluctable process of inspiration that a lot of creative people talk about. I mean, it isn't really something you can teach per se, but it is something that there are techniques for, because you can put yourself in the way of, it's like finding a good spot to fish in. Do you know what I mean? It's like there are ways of kind of making it easier. Sometimes for me, that can be reading more poetry, reading more novels, whatever. I take notes on stuff all the time, and that's more words or whatever. But I'll do stuff like, if I'm feeling particularly kind of stuck in a rut, quite often I'll pick an artist, one that I'm not super familiar with, or one that's out of my comfort zone, and just learn a whole part of their songs. Not permanently, not like I can play them forever, but like I learned every ABBA song at one point in my life. I learned every Regina Spektor song at one point in my life, you know, or Merle Haggard, for example, or whatever. But there's something about looking under the hood of other people's songs that I find is interesting, because you'll just go, that's a really cool way of getting from that chord to that chord, or that's a nice way of kind of coming out of a bridge or whatever. And you just sort of build up these kind of potential tools. But ultimately, I mean, the process of writing songs is quite a long one, in the sense that, generally speaking, and again, there isn't a set formula to this, but I'll have a sort of a pile of words that I quite like, and a pile of chords or melodies that I quite like. And that can be one line, one word, or one chord change, or it could be eight lines with a melody and a chord structure, whatever it is. And then I just sort of pick up bits of one part on the other and just sort of mash them together a bit and see if anything sparks off. And sooner or later, you have something that's approaching a song. But then I'll redraft it a few times. I'll try it, particularly I'll try it in different stylistic approaches, different tempos, different time signatures. What if this was a punk song? What if it was a country song? You know what I mean? And then I'll take it. Then I take it to my band, the Sleeping Souls, who are incredible. And then we'll work up usually more than one stylistic approach to a song and discuss kind of how it could be. Not always. You know, there are some songs where it's just like, holy fuck, that song goes like that. But then by contrast, there are some songs that we'll end up with like eight different versions of, and it's just like, but in some ways, the writing process, the creative process continues through the recording period, because you're always kind of like toying with, you know, different arrangement ideas while you're recording. I'm usually tweaking lyrics pretty late in the day. And then, you know, and then you rehearse it as a band, and you start touring it. But then songs also live as they tour as well, you know. There's a song called Photosynthesis from my second album, which is one of my Play 'Em or Get Killed songs. If you see what I mean, that was Jimmy Buffett's expression, apparently. Yeah. If I listen back to the recorded version of that now versus how we play it live, it's pretty radically different.
Okay.
I mean, the structure's the same. The melodies are mostly the same. The lyrics are mostly the same. But just the feel has completely changed, because we released that song in 2008. Do you know what I mean? And we play it every fucking day. And it's kind of cool, because I can't really remember much conscious thought going into how the arrangement has evolved. It's just kind of done it organically, and that's kind of nice.
So you reference that you've learned a bunch of different artists, such as ABBA, Regina Spektor, and a bunch of others' songs, just to look under the hood, as you mentioned. Were there any artists of songs that you learned when you were doing it at the time, you thought, oh, wow, this is much more difficult than I thought they would be?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, ABBA in particular, a band. I was fascinated by ABBA because I think their chord changes are actually really quite left field quite a lot of the time. We particularly nowadays live in a world in which pop music is increasingly focusing down on four chords. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that is what it is. And I have some songs like that myself, and I'm not throwing stones. But, you know, if you listen to Waterloo, like it starts on a one and it goes to a major second and then shifts to the major five, which then makes you feel like you've changed key three chords into a song. And that's wild, you know? And like, so, and there's not to say that I now have a song that goes one, two, five, and then does the descent thing or whatever, but it's just, it's kind of like, that's cool. It's quite liberating to understand that they've done that. And there is a sense in which, I mean, obviously chord structure is important, but your top line melody is your sort of central thing. And there's a way of selling a weird chord sequence so it doesn't sound weird, which I quite like. Do you know what I mean? And there's something, and if you do that well, I think that's really cool.
Okay. So now when you're listening to songs by other artists, is your brain able to relax and just enjoy it for what it is? Or is your creatively unpacking everything that you're listening to?
it's option two. It's definitely doing the unpacking thing. There are many days when I wish that I could just chill the fuck out and just listen to a song. Do you know what I mean? And I do get to that point. You know, there are certain artists who I'm sort of borderline obsessed with. There's a songwriter from Seattle called Pedro the Lion, Dave Bazan, who is probably my favorite writer. And he's got a new record that just came out. And it was like, cool, I'm not listening to anything else for probably 2 months. And I just listen to it on repeat because his writing is so powerful to me. And, you know, there is a fair amount of kind of like not pulling it apart eventually. Yes. Do you know what I mean? You sort of beat that part out of yourself. Yeah. But if I overhear a song on the radio that sounds cool, which happens a lot, the very first thing my brain does is be like, what's the chord sequence? Like, how's that working? Like, how's the rhythm playing against the melody or whatever?
Yeah. I'm diving into this because it's sort of referenced in what we're discussing. I'm not sure if you're aware of NLP, neuro linguistic programming. So that's the way people process information. So part of that is processing techniques or skills. Now, each of us have a dominant one, a secondary one, and a tertiary one. And we switch over, but your dominant you'll be in most of the day. Secondary, maybe a couple of hours. Your tertiary, maybe half an hour. Now, something kicks into us as a young age, as children, which makes us allow that to be our dominance. Now, visual people create pictures through the information they are receiving. Auditory people, they hear the words, they put the words into sentences, they understand the sentence and paragraph and so forth. And then kinesthetic people, I'll do that word again, kinesthetic is about the body language, the tone of voice, emotion, and the energy. Now, focusing specifically on music, not in your other sections of life, because it might change. But when you're listening to music, whether of your own songs or of other artists, are you creating a picture of what you're hearing? Are you hearing the words, or is it about the energy and the emotion?
I'd say it's options 2 and 3. I'm not an especially visual person. I can't draw to save my life. I mean, I can appreciate art, but like it's that. I mean, I can barely draw a stick man. Do you know what I mean? Like it's,
I can relate.
Sure. I am quite a words focused person as well. Outside of music, I'm a bibliophile to the point of it being slightly concerning. Like I read all the fucking time. So definitely, probably the auditory, I think, was the word that you were using.
Yes, auditory, correct.
Kinesthetic?
Kinesthetic, yes.
Kinesthetic. Yep. The thing about that, which I find interesting, is like I have friends who have, I believe the term is synesthesia.
Yes.
When it comes to music. And like, I don't have synesthesia in the way that I've heard it traditionally described, as in seeing colors and stuff like that to do with certain notes. But I definitely, at this point in my life, I feel like I have a lot of the time, like this is hard to say out loud and to phrase correctly.
Yeah.
The chords are a little bit of, it's a bit like a soap opera for me.
Yes.
Like I know that guy gets along with that guy, and I know that guy doesn't like that guy.
Yes.
And I know that those two are married, and I feel that about chords and about keys and about, even about rhythm. Like there is definitely, it's something more than just kind of music theory information that's going on. I mean, my knowledge of music theory is medium, shall we say. But there's definitely, it's medium by design, I might add, because it's like I often feel like the problem with music theory is you either need to know absolutely all of it so that you can kind of break free of it, or you kind of want to know none. And I think a little knowledge can be quite confining.
Yes.
But because I try and maintain a sense of kind of instinct and a sense of freedom in the way that I write. Do you know what I mean? And like, so for example, quite often, this has happened a few times. I'll tell you a perfect example of this. I have a song called Recovery that was one of my more successful songs. And I had the verse of it, and the verse was really cool. I didn't know where to go with it sort of intellectually. And I, let's say I've done this a lot in my time, but this is just a particular example. I just went, fuck it. And imagined I was on stage playing the song, played the verse, and it was just like, you have to play something. There's a fucking chorus coming, play something. And just played whatever came.
Yeah.
And it was the chorus that is now in the song. It was just readily apparent that it went to the 5 and then the 4.
Okay.
With the melody going to the 7 and the 1. It was just like, that's where this fucking song goes. And there was something very instinctive about that, and kind of like, you know, just sort of running off the cliff. I think find this sometimes quite a good technique, you know?
I completely get what you're saying. Now, I love having this conversation and this debate with all the artists I speak to. So I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange to say thank you to you guys for all the hard work that you're doing. I love the journey of the choice, the receiving, the unpacking, the listening to song from 1 to whatever number. I'm not sure if you're aware, CDs, even cassettes and vinyls are in a massive comeback all over the world. Vinyls last year alone in the UK, 5.9 million sales, the biggest since 1990. Also, there's a basket of products that the UK uses for income tax purposes and by monitoring the prices. Vinyls have been in that basket for a number of years, and CDs, because of their upward trajectory of sales, are now back in that basket. But then we've also got the streaming platforms that people consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
I think that's a good question. And I mean, this is a sidebar thing, but like CDs sound fucking great, by the way.
Of course,
like,
yes. Yes.
But like there has been that the huge audiophiles always bang on about vinyl, and I have a lot of time for vinyl, but I do often find that CDs sound really rich and full,
yes,
in a way,
absolutely,
that is underappreciated. So yes. I just want to throw that out there. I think it's an interesting moment. My experience, and it's important to say that obviously I operate in the kind of like, cottage industry part of the industry. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like I'm on an independent label and I have a
yes.
established fan base. It's people who buy my music tend to be quite dedicated to it. Do you know what I mean? I don't often sort of, have kind of like casual consumers of what I do. People
yeah, are
really
it.
Into
yeah.
it or they're not aware kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's definitely a sense in which people buy physical format music as a kind of gesture of solidarity. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, I wish to contribute to this economy. Vinyl looks cool. You can get it signed. You can stick it on your wall. I mean, I know for a fact there are a lot of people who buy my vinyls and never actually listen to the vinyl. You know what I mean? Like, they'll listen to it on Spotify, but they want to contribute. And that's cool. I like that. That works for me. For me, personally, listening to vinyls are really kind of, there's something slightly ritualistic about listening to vinyl.
Yes.
There's something about the way that it kind of it demands your attention, because among other things you have to flip it over in a way that having Spotify on while you're doing the washing up is not really the same thing, you know. So there's definitely kind of there are differences to those sort of forms of consumption. I guess I think the thing that to me always feels important to say is that the thing that's happened with the streaming world particularly is that it has democratized distribution in a pretty extreme way. I was talking to Brett Gurewitz, who runs Epitaph Records a few years ago, and the way he put it, which I think is wise, he sort of said, you know, in the 80s, distribution was the challenge. To record an album well and then get it pressed and then get it in stores was fucking hard.
Yeah.
And if you got to that point, you'd kind of done it. Do you know what I mean? Like, you had successfully done the thing. Nowadays, recording's much, much easier. You know, most people have GarageBand or whatever on a laptop, and, you know, recording can be pretty simple at a reasonably high quality. And, you know, Billie Eilish is making records in a bedroom, all this kind of thing. And then the distribution's pretty easy as well, in the sense that it's really easy to sign up for Spotify or indeed Bandcamp or SoundCloud or whatever it might be. And what the competition now is an attention economy, in the sense that yeah. there is, as we both know, infinitely more than 24 hours worth of new music released there on Spotify every single day, which means that even putting aside all the music that was released before 9 a.m. this morning, it's impossible for one person to be up to speed on all the music in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And so from the point of view of an artist, the challenge is to get people to pay attention to what you're doing as opposed to what 9 million other people are doing,
yeah.
and indeed to try and maintain that information, that attention, sorry, and to sustain that engagement with your audience. And that is a slightly different thing. And so, broadly speaking, I sort of have mixed feelings about it. I think the fact that, as I say, distribution has been so radically democratized is, broadly speaking, a good thing, because it removes the chokehold and the gatekeeping and all that kind of thing. I think there is still a place for record labels in the world. I know people who are like, there's no need for labels anymore. And I'm like, there's some. There are things that can be done. In 2013, I did my first record on a major label and had the company behind me, and it was remarkable how much power they can exert over the music marketplace if they choose to do so.
Yes.
So there is still a place for that, but I guess the other edge of the sword, if you like, to this sort of great democratization thing, is that as an artist, suddenly you find yourself being asked to be like good at social media and understanding what TikTok is and all this sort of shit. And I mean, this does make me kind of an old man with a walking stick to shouting at a cloud to some degree, but it's like, I don't fucking know what TikTok is and I don't care.
Yeah.
I have no interest in what TikTok is. I never did. And it's just, there's a part of me that slightly resents the fact that I've also now got to be funny in 30-second clips and, yes. And photogenic and all this sort of shit. And it's just, it's like, I want to play the guitar and sing and write songs and do shows. And, you know, there are days, we've taken younger bands out on tour of sports who will spend money on a social media before they spend money on a sound guy. And I'm just like, that's fucking crazy to me. Maybe they know what they're doing in the sense that they look good on social media and then they put the studio audio over the top of it. And it's like, great. But not in every case, but in some cases they can't fucking play. So like, who cares? Do you know what I mean? So there is a little part of me that's kind of like, just sort of like plowing my furrow and doing my thing and putting my head down, trying to write good songs, record them well, play good shows, and just sort of hope that the world, enough of the world sort of maintains interest for me to maintain a career. I do have a TikTok account. I do have an Instagram account. I do have a whatever the fuck Twitter's called this week account. I use them as broadcast tools rather than conversation tools. I don't read comments. I don't reply to comments. I don't engage on there because if you want to engage with me, I mean, my email address is public domain. I reply to emails all day, every day, which is the thing I've always done and will always do. But come to a show. Do you know what I mean? To me, music is about connection. It's about that moment of gathering, the dissolution of boundaries between people and all that kind of thing. And ultimately, there's a sense to me in which the internet broadly is a false god on that kind of thing. And I think we learned a lot of that during COVID and all the rest. It was like, hey, we can all exist and still carry on our lives on Zoom or whatever. And it's kind of like, you can and you can't, do you know what I mean? And I think a lot of the kind of issues that are affecting younger people, particularly these days, are because it's like Instagram or Reddit or whatever is not a substitute for physical community.
Yep, exactly.
Sorry, that was a long and rant.
No, it's perfect. So you referenced this connection with the live audience. Now, I'm that dude who's standing right in front. I'll take my cell phone out for a couple of pictures, a couple of videos, and I put my phone away. I notice a lot of times a lot of people have their cell phones out for longer periods of time, tweeting, posting, videoing, photoing, whatever they're doing. So the person on the stage receiving potentially a bunch of phones compared to a bunch of eyes, does that bother you or is it just where society is at the moment?
It bothered me more when it started, when camera phones first became a thing. I don't love it, in many ways, I don't love it on behalf of the person holding the phone. It's like, you're fucking up. You're missing the moment.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And like, there's something happening right now in front of your eyes. You're never going to watch that fucking video. Shut the fuck up. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and it's just like, I mean, actively, since that became a thing, there are areas of my life that I've been trying to de-digitize, should we say. So, for example, in 2012, when I did my first arena show and then we got asked to play at the Olympic opening ceremony, it was this insane year for me where everything was going mad. And I took myself off for 2 weeks in the summer and I walked this thing called the South Downs Way, which is an ancient Anglo-Saxon footpath that runs for 110 miles in the south of England. And it goes through the village I was born in. So happy, well, raised in, I should say. Happy days. And that quite specifically took no camera or phone or anything with me. And I did it on my own. And all I have from that trip is the memories in my mind. Mm. And in some ways, they're much more vivid to me now because I don't have like a handful of snippets of it as I was going, you know? Yeah. Ultimately, I think often the kind of bands trying to police crowd behavior thing gets a little much. I mean, I do. I try and police crowd behavior in the sense that I'm like, don't be a fucking asshole. Don't physically or sexually abuse the people around you, whatever the fuck. But like, if somebody's brought a phone, they want to hold it up, that's on them. But it's just, and obviously there are extreme examples of it. I mean, I have friends who've lost their temper because they're trying to sing to the audience and there's like eight people jamming a phone into their face. And I think you're kind of within your rights to just smack them away
exactly.
At that point. But I just think, you know, I just think it's a little bit of a shame in some ways.
I totally agree with you. Now, I love this game. I know if I had to ask this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 50 years, 8 minutes. I know your answer will be different every time simply because there are millions of them. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to 5 songs once we finish this conversation, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
A lot of them would be by Pedro the Lion because his new record came out quite recently. So I'm very obsessed with Pedro the Lion right now. His new record is called Santa Cruz and it's very good. There's a song, to pick one, there's a song on that record called Don't Cry Now, which is... a remarkable piece of writing, in my opinion. So that's the first one. What the hell is the name of the artist? There's a song called I Can Help. It's an old country song. I Can Help. And we're using it as our walk-off music at the moment because I just adore that song. So that's definitely on the list. I'm on tour right now with a guy called Ben Brown. I produced his EP. I think it's completely brilliant. All the songs in it are brilliant, but there's a song called Dancing With Your Eyes Closed, which is definitely, it's a wedding song. Do you know what I mean? I mean that in a good way. Like it's a strikingly beautiful piece of romantic songwriting. So that's on my list. Continuing down that road, The Meffs, the other band we have out, who I've also produced, who are just everything I want a punk band to be. They're fucking in your face, angry, funny, great, tight. Their most recent single is called Clowns. I would listen to that. And then finally, my current sort of favorite band in the world, other than Pedro the Lion, is a band from Canada called No Bro, who are a raging feminist punk band who I just think are completely brilliant. They have a song called Let's Do Drugs, which, that's what it says on the tin. So I would pick that one.
Cool. So now what's coming up short term the rest of the year? You said you're on tour after that. Do you have any plans or you're just blowing out with the tour?
So this tour runs for another 4 days or something. And then I've got a couple of weeks off and then the next tour starts. Essentially, my new record came out 2 months ago. Plan for this record, in some ways, it's the plan for every record, but much more so on this record, is to focus on the international thing. So like, this year, we're kind of doing I don't like the expression, but the A markets. So I mean, USA, Canada, Australia, Europe, UK, USA, that kind of thing. But I'm working with a new record label in this record, and they have offices all over the world. So my plan for next year is to be in Central and South America, in Japan, in Singapore, and Eastern Europe, and, you know, and then probably back around the UK and the US again at the end of all of that. But like, but broadly put, I'm going to be on tour for a long time with this record. The other thing I would say, like, I actually haven't really written much new music lately, which is quite unusual for me. But I'm very pleased with the last record. It's my 10th album. Feels like a not unreasonable time to just take a moment. Do you know what I mean? Exactly. To kind of reassess. So the short answer to your question is I'm going to be on tour forever. I'm very happy about that. I am too.
But then you must add South Africa to your list, please.
I was going to say, so I have been to South Africa on tour one time, which was in 2014, I believe, which is now 10 years ago, which is crazy. It is very much my intention to return sooner rather than later.
Okay, cool. So when you're here next, I'll be cheering you right up in front without my cell phone for most of the time. And then we'll have a quick hello if you've got time or chat afterwards.
I would love that. We'll have a beer.
There we go. So Frank, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
I would like to say thank you for everybody's time and attention. Check out the new record and I will see you on tour somewhere at least reasonably close to where you are.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.